This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm David Kalman in for Pia. Every Wednesday, we bring you a bonus podcast, one hand-picked story from the week's round of the Sunday magazine that we think's definitely worth hearing or hearing again. Of course, you can hear all our stories on the full podcast that we put out on Sundays. It's on the CBC Listen app. All right, here is this week's highlight. Sounds from the heart of the continent.
The driver checks the mirror 7 minutes late. The crowded rider's restlessness enunciates. The guess who sucked, the jets were lousy anyway. The same route every day. And in the turning lane, someone stalled again. He's talking to himself and hears the price of gas repeat his phrase. I hate Winnipeg.
I hate Winnipeg, maybe in the lyrics, but the song is One Great City by one of Winnipeg's great bands, the Weaker Thans. Great. One way to describe Manitoba's capital, it is my hometown. Last year, the Globe and Mail ranked it as the top city in Canada to raise a family and described it as artsy and chill. But Winnipeg has also been named our country's coldest city, our poorest city. In 2015, Maclean's called Winnipeg our most racist city. But to Negan Sinclair, it is about more than all of those hot or cold takes. Winnipeg is a vital Indigenous center, ground zero of Canada's future, and most importantly to him, home. Negan is a columnist for the Winnipeg Free Press and a professor in the University of Manitoba's Department of Indigenous Studies. In his new essay collection, he marries his personal stories of Winnipeg with reflections on how the city helps tell the story of Canada. It's called Winnipeg, Visions of Canada from an Indigenous Center. And Pia Chattopadhyay spoke with Negan a few days ago.
Bonjour, Tansé, hello. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. You know, you write that Winnipeg is constantly being called the most this or that, declared, you know, either as a national dud or a darling, depending kind of on the day. But it always has that the most something attached to it. Why do you think Canada and Canadians are always trying to figure Winnipeg out, like to define it in some way?
Well, the truth is that Winnipeg is the site of the first footstep of Canada. So 1867, Confederation, the very first thing this country does when Upper Canada and Lower Canada come together is look to the West and try to figure out, A, how to put a train line to get all the resources to the East, but then also try to figure out this very complicated, but yet framed as not complicated issue of how to engage Indigenous peoples. And that will become an obsession for the country for the next 150 plus years and arguably still today. And I think that's the characterization of what Winnipeg looks like. Canada just can't figure it out. And so when Canada brings all of its Canadian things to Winnipeg, Winnipeg does something different with it.
What do you mean by that?
You talked about the Maclean's magazine headline, gets a lot of attention, did get a lot of attention here in Winnipeg at the time. You know, it's funny you played John K. Sampson's song. You know, I think there's a thing about Winnipeggers is we hate Winnipeg, but nobody else is allowed to hate Winnipeg. and so like all of us, we like to, you know, debate and fight and argue about our city. But we really hate it when people, particularly from the East, come in and sort of announce what they think about the place and put it on a screaming headline. The problem is that Winnipeg is not the most racist city in the country, never has been, never will be. We are in a country that is has a foundation of racism and that you just see it most in Winnipeg. And we have a proportional Indigenous population of 20%. So that means one in five people in your dentist office and your in the mall in your workplace, even in your school, is Indigenous. And then the other 4/5 are living beside, working beside, or married to an Indigenous person. And so that means that we don't pretend like racism doesn't exist. We talk about it every day. We engage it every day. And no one in this city, no matter what your political stripe is, no matter what your gender, sexuality is, can ignore it. We have to talk about it. Hmm. And so therefore you see this kind of solutions to Canada, to Canada's obsession of taking Indigenous lands, of bringing forth a sort of Judeo-Christian vision for the country, and doing something different happens in Manitoba. I think the country can't figure that out. In areas like, you know, Saskatchewan, northwestern Ontario, I would say that there's a similar demographic that are also the solutions are happening here, but particularly in Manitoba.
How so? Like, tell me about some of those solutions.
Yeah, I mean, none of that is to shy away. So just in the context of the interview that we're having right now, there is a trial in Winnipeg for a serial killer, an admitted serial killer of Indigenous women whose remains are in landfills. I mean, we have an ongoing genocide, an ongoing situation of violence, and the most impacted are women, Indigenous women, girls and Two-Spirit people. So we could talk about child welfare, we could talk about justice, we could talk about the jail system or the who sleeps outside at night here on the streets of Winnipeg. So this is not to deny that there is not inherent violence happening in this place, but the solutions that are happening are some of the most innovative and, frankly, creative. They're unprecedented in the country. Nowhere else will you see people who put their lives on the line to give out sandwiches in the downtown core that are made by churches that are Canadians that have otherwise no reason to come downtown. They don't work down here. They live out in the outskirts. Nowhere else in the country do you see when they make territorial acknowledgements at meetings or at big sporting events that people cheer for this. Nowhere else in the country do you see this kind of rapid commitment, not just on September 30th to wear an orange t-shirt, but you see it every single day, whether it be in the downtown core or in the outskirts schools or throughout the province. Nowhere else in the country do you see the most racist provincial election fought in this country's entire history, where one party said, we're never going to search for Indigenous women in landfills. But the answer to that election was that the Manitoba electorate, most of them non-Indigenous, voted for a party led by a First Nations person. And regardless of what party you support, that is a remarkable thing that happened last October here in Manitoba. And I think it's indicative of a shift in a long conversation that's been happening in this place that results in a lot of creative solutions.
Hmm. We'll talk more about Premier Wab Kanew in just a bit. But I want to talk about one specific sort of innovative solution that you highlight that I think speaks to what you're getting at. So this is the Mama Bear Clan. This is a community patrol group. So can you just tell me like the work it does and why groups like it are effective in your city?
So I've been doing frontline poverty work since the early 1990s when I was 18 years old, and I'm now 30 years into that work and with a few breaks for traveling elsewhere and so far on the way. But never have I seen the kind of broad-scale, all-hands-on-deck approach that is taking place in some of the poorest postal codes in the country, which is Point Douglas, Winnipeg's North End, the downtown core, the West End. You know, I mean, these are areas that are oftentimes classified and are viewed by the rest of the country as these problem areas. And you know, arguably, some Manitobans see it that way as well. The fact is that in those communities, you're seeing radical approaches, mostly based on Indigenous teachings. Because most times what we're seeing in those communities are new immigrants and recently people from Ukraine, from Syria, people who are coming to the community for the first time, and then they're meeting with Indigenous peoples who oftentimes are going to the airport and drumming them in and welcoming them, calling them treaty people, helping them to understand what that means to be in the relationship with community. And these foundational relationships, which have always been in this place, which have always been about Indigenous peoples inviting newcomers into relationships, into things called treaties, but now might be just a friendly neighborhood or, in the case of Mama Bear Clan, a patrol where we agree to go together and to try to engage the issue of domestic violence, or try to engage the issue of crime, try to engage the issue of what does it mean to have an encampment in our community and how do we treat those people as not those people, but as neighbors and as relatives.
When you go to North Point Douglas, which is one of the poorer neighborhoods in Winnipeg. And I would say, you know, every city has areas with reputations, and this is one of those places in Winnipeg. But when you go there, Negan, you see something that goes beyond that descriptor I just gave. What do you see when you go there?
I see a whole bunch of things, but the most marked thing I see is that was the place that my grandfather would sleep outside. So those are that's the areas where the kind of most famous bars are. That it, the train line is right there. So when the train line from the east was installed in our community, that was the place in which goods were sent east, but then peoples would come, immigrants would come, and they would often stay in hotels, and there was a lot of bars built up in that area. So it became a kind of a hub place, a place, particularly the 1940s and 50s and 60s, as kind of this place of a lot of transiency and a lot of things that we might think of as kind of fights or conflicts or between races, between communities. And then, of course, Indigenous peoples are plopped right there because that's our traditional territory right downtown in a community that used to be called Nestawea. And Nestawea was a 14,000 Indigenous person city before the city of Winnipeg was here. That Anishinaabe, Cree, Lakota, Dakota, Nakota peoples lived together in that place for thousands of years before settlers even arrived. And so my grandfather slept on the street there, and he was a residential school survivor who'd been abused in residential school, but he'd also went to World War II and witnessed horrendous horrors on the grounds of France with the Toronto Scottish. And so when he came back, he could not parent. He could not be a person in our community that would, someone who would be very proud. And so he self-harmed a lot, and he did that with alcohol, and he ended up suffering a lot. And I used to actually party with the famous Tommy Prince. That was one of his best friends, and the two of them used to take care of each other, but the two of them also used to sleep outside together and take care of each other's goods that they wouldn't get assaulted or they wouldn't get stolen. And so when I go to the North Point Douglas community, that is every single person I see is my grandfather. So I see them as a relative. Mm. They are my family. And as a result, and the truth is that I do have lots of family down there. I have people that have been flooded out in Peguis from my First Nation, people who have been constantly put into hotels and have suffered from that. I have people who I've met now for 30 years working in the downtown core, people I knew who were artists and they first were struggling 1990s, and now here they are a few years later. And on top of that, I also have students, northern students who have come to the University of Manitoba and for one reason or another started to struggle and end up in the community in which they're needing a little bit of help. So the first thing I always say is I love you, I care about you. And sometimes that's in the form of offering a resource or a sandwich. But most importantly, it's my time. And I think every Winnipegger has the obligation to give that time to our relatives, as we do in community centers and hockey games. But we also should do that in the areas that have perhaps most been harmed by having electricity in our houses or having paved roads or having the abundant big homes that Winnipeggers live in. We have an obligation to those who have paid for those things over a long period of time.
You know, when you talk about your grandpa Henry, as you call him, you guys were really close, right? He had a big role in your upbringing. You two shared a special bond.
Oh, I guess I should have known that you're going to go there. I get very emotional talking about my grandpa because he was the man that taught me about love. And you know, it'd be weird if you knew my grandpa because he was such a violent person, and he was such a person who is sort of known in our community in Selkirk as being this alcoholic. And he certainly, for my father and for my uncles and my auntie, he was not a kind person. He was a person who, you know, brought a lot of harm to their life, physical violence to their life, not sexual violence, but physical violence. And so it's hard to talk about those stories, but I never knew any of that because when I was born, my father stood up to his own father and said, "You cannot come around him, your grandson, if you've been drinking." And so my grandpa, which no one would have blamed him if he drank himself to death. Like no one would have blamed him. The people would have went, "Oh, well, there's a wounded veteran. Oh, there's a residential school survivor. Oh, too bad." And if he slept outside in minus 40 degree weather, because about 6 months of Manitoba's winter, and he had died out there, people would have went, "Oh, well, and that's sad," and turn the page. He didn't do that. He chose me, like he chose me, and he chose to show me the best parts of himself. And so as a result, all I ever knew was love from this remarkable guy who had been damaged by the war. He couldn't hear out of either ear. He could only write me notes. And all he really needed was just a guy to, you know, a young boy to help him get changed in the morning, make him craft dinner. And I can tell you, I've never rolled so many cigarettes over about a 10-year span than I did with my grandpa. And, you know, I was, a 7 years old rolling cigarettes for him all afternoon.
I can feel the love.
Yeah.
From Toronto to Winnipeg. You're listening to the Sunday Magazine. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, and I'm speaking with Negan Sinclair. Negan has a new essay collection out. It's called Winnipeg, Visions of Canada from an Indigenous Center. And as you can hear from him, it is a mix of personal stories and political ones and how those things all intersect. And to that end, Negan, I want to talk about a trial that you referenced just a little while ago. There's this trial that's been gripping much of our country, specifically your city. You've been writing about it in your newspaper columns lately. This is a trial of a man who admitted to killing four women. Prosecutors allege he preyed on vulnerable Indigenous women at homeless shelters in Winnipeg. He's pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder charges. His lawyers argue he should be found not criminally responsible for the deaths due to a mental disorder. We'll see what happens in the legal realm, but how has this story been impacting Winnipeg, your city?
It's anything people talk about. Like, that's everything that people talk about. I was at a gathering just last night with an elder who opened the prayer. And normally when we open a prayer, we talk about the territory. We talk about the love and the commitment that we're making in a space to do some work together. And this was an elder, Geraldine Shingus, who's been supporting the Myron family. And so a lot of the prayer ended up about that. And I think everybody wanted to talk about that. They wanted to acknowledge the tremendous pain that Indigenous families are feeling as a result of this horrendous, horrific crime that takes place. You know, a reporter colleague of mine said this is Manitoba's Picton trial, because there is evidence that within this individual's apartment, there are DNA of other women, and some of them have been missing. And so some of them are unknown. And the fact is that, you know, I probably met this person on my work with dealing with the Mama Bear Clan and walking in the patrols, because he had frequented those places. He certainly was a beneficiary of the building that my group alongside the, you know, I don't head up this group. These are led by grandmothers who the Mama Bear Clan heads up, but I'm one of the captains. And so the grandmothers directed us a number of years ago to build a warming center. And so we did that, which was called Ndinawimok. And in that area is one of the areas that he was frequented, and he was on camera to being in those places. I probably met him. I can tell you, though, that when I saw him in the courtroom, it put chills inside of me, not just because this was an individual who perpetrated horrendous crimes, but it is because he looked so normal. And he looked like a typical person that you might just meet anywhere. And what I mean by that is that when the police pulled his computers, they found two things. One is that he has a long history of researching white supremacy. And the second is that he also had a very long history of researching residential school denialism. And so these are things that I think people call free speech, or certainly people in, like, historians or professors in universities go, oh, I'm just putting ideas out there that I don't believe that survivors suffered in residential schools, or that children died in those places. The fact is that when you permeate those beliefs, when you put those things out there irresponsibly and without any evidence and a bunch of unaccountable ideas, and you call it free speech, people read these things. And when they read these things, then they get infected with hatred. And then these individuals perpetrate crimes like this. And the reality is that this isn't just an issue of one individual, and that even if he were to start make the claim of mental health, where did the mental health come from, or the mental illness come from? It came from hatred that exists within our country, within Manitoba, within Winnipeg, and that this hatred then infects and then has real life impacts on real life people.
And this, of course, is all in the context of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. This is not just an emotional issue for your city and our country. It is a matter of crime. It is a matter of accountability. And it is a matter of politics. And this is where I want to bring Premier Wab Kanu back into our conversation. When he was running to be elected as the head of the NDP, he campaigned on searching a landfill for the for some of the victims. This has been a very contentious issue ongoing in your city. And at the time, his conservative competitor, incumbent premier, Heather Stephenson, refused to do that. Wobkanu won that election. And there was a lot of celebration of Wobkanu and being the first Indigenous premier and stuff. But what does that tell you about where are these conversations, these national conversations, but also these very local ones for Winnipeg are headed?
Yeah, I mean, Wob also did Premier Canoe. It's hard. I've known Wob for such a long period of time. I keep having to call him Premier Canoe. The Premier Canoe also committed to making sure that Louis Riel was recognized as the first Indigenous premier of this province. And I think that shows a real interest in engagement and engaging Manitobans, the, you know, capital M Manitobans. The challenge is, of course, that he's always going to be labeled in particular ways. And I think he's always going to be labeled in a political framework where, you know, he is a part of a party. And so the real problem with that last provincial election is that we're talking about human lives here. Right around the same time that there was debate around searching the landfill in Manitoba, there was that absolute inane situation involving millionaires in a submarine joyriding and looking down at the Titanic. And then, of course, that accident that happened in their submarine. And there was a federal minister who said, we will spare no expense to look for them. We will spend all the money necessary to bring up the wreckage. We will make sure that Canadians know the answer of what happened. And then at the exact same time here in Manitoba, we know exactly where the remains of two women are who have been killed by a serial killer. The families deserve, these are our relatives. These are people who are neighbors. These are people who walk by us in the mall and share classrooms with us. And so the reality is that we're willing to spend millions of dollars for people who chose to put themselves in harm's way. And absolutely, I'm not here to judge human life, but I'm here to say that these are human beings in our community, and politicizing that issue is so irresponsible, so disrespectful, but is in the same vein, the same belief system that Indigenous peoples don't matter, particularly Indigenous women, girls, and Two-Spirit peoples. They don't matter. We need to talk about them in terms of feasibility, but when it's millionaires, we never debate feasibility. What we do is we say, we got to go look for them. The reality is that when we have women in landfills in Manitoba, that's on everybody. That's not on an Indigenous issue in any way. But the one party in Manitoba made it an issue about Indigenous peoples and going, oh, they don't matter, or it's not feasible. That's what the words that was used. And another party said, we're going to look for them because they're relatives or they're part of our community, and we don't leave people behind in Manitoba. Regardless of what political party that you're in, the reality is that one message was about everybody. Another message was about those people.
I want to talk about something else. As you know, and some of our listeners know, I come from Saskatchewan, born and raised there. And people in Toronto often say to me,
oh, it took you a while to bring it up, but there you go.
And I would say, no, it was wonderful. I had all these friends from different backgrounds. In other words, the prairies are very diverse. If you've never been there, don't have the stereotypical view of what the prairies are in your head. We have diverse communities everywhere. And so I really want to talk to you about the Kowalchuks. You write about the Kowalchuks. This is a family with whom you have no blood ties. This essay is called Relations. And I love this because I think when you live on the prairies and you just have so many different kinds of friends, despite what some other Canadians might think the prairies look like. So who are the Kowalchuks to you?
I'm so happy you asked. I think they're going to be embarrassed that I'm talking about them on a radio show, but I'll tell them to listen in. The Kowalchuks are my other family. They took care of me growing up. I only call them Mr. and Mrs. Kowalchuk, even though I know their parent. I know Kelly's my best friend, who's their son. We went to school every year together, played sports together. But Mr. and Mrs. Kowalchuk always cared for me. And one of the things that was the most significant is that, they aren't my blood relatives, but they're a Ukrainian family who take their traditions very seriously. And Ukrainian Christmas is my birthday. And so I always, on every one of my birthdays that I can remember, when I'd be by their house or maybe the next day, is that they would always make sure to save a few pierogies for me and save some food for me. And I never went without being fed or having a place to sleep or being told how valuable and how much I'm loved. by the Kowalczyks. They live in Lockport, which is just near where I grew up. They're a rural family. And, you know, the relationship between Ukrainians and indigenous peoples is very close.
Yeah, tell me about that. I loved reading about
you, this. If you go to Cree communities in northern Manitoba, you'll see these beautiful scarves that Kukums wear. And you might ask yourself, well, where did those come from? Like, they come from Ukrainians. They're the famous sort of babushka scarves that Ukrainian women brought to relationships here in Treaty 1 territory, Treaty 2 territory. And so you'll still see that tradition in Cree communities of these beautiful scarves, which were traded for back in the day. And you'll also see Ukrainians who have deep, deep ties, oftentimes familial ties, married into indigenous families, and a lot of relationships between people along the Red River who sometimes might refer to themselves as Métis, but very much have that last part of their name Chuck, and there'll be different families. And you also see very deep ties with indigenous peoples and Icelandic peoples. My stepfather is Icelandic, and so he's a Borkfjord, and he can draw his community, his name, his family all the way back to Iceland. But I can tell you what else he can do is he can also draw a connection to me, to my family. And if you go to Iceland, they still smoke fish the way that they learned from the Cree here in Manitoba.
Wow.
And they took that tradition back to Iceland. So the way that, you know, Icelanders smoked fish for a long time, but then they came to Manitoba, took that tradition back to Iceland, and they said, this is better. And so in Iceland, you can see the Cree way of smoking fish, which is all across that entire island.
I will just tell you, my sister grew up dancing, including doing Ukrainian dancing, kid of Indian immigrants growing up in Saskatchewan. So her last name became Chattopadhyaychuk.
that's an instance of creation. That's a prairie moment there.
Yeah. Your book is such a love letter to your city, and love in the most beautiful, giving ways, and also that tough love, like in how we love in all these ways. You call your book Winnipeg. W-I-N-I-P-E-K. What does Winnipeg mean? Not just literally, but also more symbolically for you.
So Winnipeg is not just the kind of mispronunciation or anglicized way of saying Winnipeg, but Winnipeg refers to, like, if you say the word properly, so Winnipeg, and it refers to Nibbe, which is that word in the middle. It's talking about water, and Epec, Winnipeg, is referring to, people will say, oh, the clouded water or the dirty water. That's usually what people goes, oh, it's the dirty water. Well, what floats in the water that makes it clouded? It's the algae, or what we refer to as the atigib. And so when you say the word Winnipeg and you say it properly, what you're referring to is the algae in the water that is influenced by the Lake Winnipeg watershed. So that's a huge sort of valley, which then funnels into Lake Winnipeg, because Winnipeg is about the lake. It's not about the city. So Winnipeg is saying the algae in the water comes from this massive watershed, and that goes all the way on to Alberta, to Saskatchewan, Northwest Territories, into Northwestern Ontario, into Wisconsin, Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota, and even into Montana. And so everything that happens on those lands end up in Lake Winnipeg. And it picks up things along the way and creates algae. That's shampoo in your hair. That's oil fracking projects. That's the pollution that the sewage that the city of Winnipeg dumps into the Red River system. That all becomes algae. And so Cree people, when they named this place, knew that there was an ecology that was special ecology that created algae. And that when there was more rainfall, when things would happen, when we would deforest the area, we would get increased algae. But when we would take care of the land, we would get the appropriate amount of algae where the fish would be plentiful and the land would be plentiful. And so within that very name, Winnipeg, when we say it properly, well, we're actually talking about an ethic, like a land ethic. Hmm. We're talking about biology. We're talking about ecology. Probably most of all, though, we're talking about geography. We're actually talking about the entire watershed. And when I was working on this, I kept thinking to myself, well, when we're talking about Winnipeg, it's not really fair to talk about the city. What we're really talking about is everything that happens and that the city's only a part of that, even though I end up talking a lot about Winnipeg. But in this book, I end up talking about my hometown of Selkirk. I talk about northern Manitoba. I talk about the United States. I talk a little bit about Alberta and Saskatchewan and northwestern Ontario. And, you know, it's hard because everything funnels into this place from elsewhere. And this is the landing place of so many of those ideas. And if you go back to Confederation, how we started this conversation, it is the first footstep of this country is in Treaty 1, which is negotiated in 1871, just a few years after Confederation, the Manitoba Act of 1870, the very first province that's created. So this is the first footstep of this country. And I think we have yet to take many more steps, but this footstep in this place is also a place that has created such incredible possibility, not just for this place, but for the entirety of the country.
I appreciate you so much. Thanks, Negan.
Oh, well, Miigwech, thanks so much for your time.
That is Pia's conversation with Negan Sinclair. His new book is called Winnipeg, Visions of Canada from an Indigenous Center. You can find all the stories we bring you each week on the Sunday Magazine over on our website, cbc.ca/Sunday. I'm David Common. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again next Sunday.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.